Hello everyone, this is Omar Alvarado of theparadiddler.com, the blog for all things drumming. Thank you for tuning into this podcast. I'm pretty certain that most, if not all, that are listening to this podcast enjoy listening to and or playing the drums. And when we play, it's very likely that we want to hear our performances at a later time. We've all heard songs where the drum sound is really bad and wondered, how'd they get away with that? While at other times, we've certainly heard a wonderfully recorded drumming performance. We certainly would like to not only get a good recording of our drumming, but also a good mix in the end. But achieving that end may be a bit confusing, since there are so many options to consider regarding number and type of microphones, their placement, recording devices, mixing consoles, mixing software, etc. All of these factors can be very daunting even for someone with intermediate experience, let alone a newbie. Well, today we have someone that can help in that regard. He's not only a recording and mixing engineer, but he has a soft spot for recording and mixing drums, and that's music to any drummer's ears. He's the author of the book Recording Drums, The Complete Guide, and we're very happy to have with us mixer, producer, and recording engineer Mike Major. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Omar. How about you?
Pretty good, thanks. Appreciate it. Well, we definitely want to get into your book, Recording Drums, The Complete Guide, you know, at least a little bit, and what you're up to lately. But I'd like to start off with some of your background, Mike. So before we get into all that stuff, tell us a little bit about your background in music and in drums.
Well, I started off as a drummer, which I think should be pretty obvious considering how drum-centric everything I'm doing is seems to have become. Yeah, I started off as a drummer, you know, played in bands for many years, you know, in high school, played all through high school, and then had a band for about 7 years from the end of high school on. And while I was in the band, I was the guy who, you know, was interested in the, you know, making sure the PA was set up right. If we went and recorded something, I was always sitting there at the console next to whoever was recording it. And it always seemed interesting to me, but I can't say that I ever looked at it and thought that it would be something that was going to be a career for me. But, you know, to me, it was all about my drums, period. Yep. You know, I was obsessive about being a good drummer for a very long time. But eventually, after doing, you know, helping out enough with setting up our sound systems and, you know, working side by side with a legitimate recording engineer in a studio, then I started to kind of pique my interest. And so I started doing small sound jobs with a guy who I knew. This is when I was in El Paso. And started working on shows with him. And, you know, he was teaching me a little bit about first of all, how to hook things up on a PA system, and then some basic console setup type stuff that really, ironically, I still use today when I'm doing live sound. You know, it's funny that someone could tell me something that was so significant that early that it's still kind of my guideline. But so with this guy who I was working with, he was running sound systems for a guy named Rod Crosby, who owned Rosewood Studio, which happened to be the studio that I ran for about 18 years in El Paso. But at the time, the guy who I was doing these PA jobs with was also running that studio. And so I went in one day for a session where somebody had hired me to play drums on a session. And this guy who I work with was recording it. And, you know, after we started working on a drum sound and, you know, doing takes, you know, I went into the control room and he was like, you know, you should mess around with the console. You know, you could probably do something with this. You know, it's like, you're a drummer, you know, you probably have an ear for this. Give it a try. And so I got a chance to kind of put my hand on the console and, you know, mess around with things a bit. And it was really kind of like, wow, it was exciting on one hand. And it was also kind of made me think that it's like, well, I bet if I understood this better, I could really make sure my drums were recorded right. Because, you know, up until that point, I'd probably recorded, I don't know, 4 or 5 times, you know, a few with just guys bringing stuff to our rehearsal place, and a few times in real studios. And I was never, you know, I was always okay with the drum sound, but I was never like knocked over. It wasn't like listening to someone else's record and going, man, listen, I'll go to the drum sound. So it maybe early on that became like that was my new obsession. It's like, well, I have to figure out how to record drums better, because
yeah, once you got your hands on it,
absolutely, and you know, even more so because you know it can be done. You know, you've heard proof that other people can do a good job recording drums. So you know, there must be a path to, you know, to kind of acquiring that knowledge and experience. So you know, I read a lot. I would, I mean, this was pre-internet days, really. You know, read magazine articles, I'd buy books, you know, I'd talk to people. If you worked with someone who was way more experienced than you, then you'd kind of look over their shoulder, ask a few questions, you know, just the kind of the typical, I guess what used to be a more typical way of learning it. It was a bit of a, maybe, you know, master and apprenticeship type thing.
Lots of notes taking.
I mean, you know, and really, I mean, I came to find over time that a lot of it was certainly exposure to things, but it was also getting the opportunity to try things, you know, just the trial and error. And being that ultimately, after I worked with this guy for a while, I think a year or two later is when I started actually running the studio myself. I really had no business running the studio because I didn't know much about recording at the time, but an opportunity came up and I took it. And it was just kind of a trial by fire that I just started doing sessions and somehow, you know, got stuff on tape and, you know, I was able to give people cassettes when they walked out, you know. So, So beyond that, it was really between doing live sound and recording, it was just, you know, I had a lot of opportunity to try stuff. And I really think that was probably the biggest turning point for me initially was once I started doing nothing but sound and recording as my job, then I got better much faster. Because it wasn't like, okay, I go to my job and then at nights I'm mixing for bands in a club. You know, I did that for a while. I was working in a restaurant, you know, and then mixing for a band every night. You know, like bands that used to do these club tours, and they'd kind of be in residence at a club for 6 days, and I'd go and mix them. But you know, there's something to be said for mixing 3 hours every night, you know, weeks on end. You know, you do get better, and then when you don't have to think about any other job, and that's the only thing you're doing, and it's even easier, I guess, to not only become more confident, but just to experience more, I guess. So. You know, and then beyond that, it's just really I've just, you know, kind of, like I said, I've been obsessive about trying to get better and better at recording drums. And every session I would try something new, you know, maybe something worked to the last session, so I use that again. But, you know, I maybe try it in a different way on the next session or try some mic that I've never tried on something. Or, you know, there's just to me, it's about never stagnating, I guess, you know, and it's much like drumming. You know, you always want to keep your perspectives fresh. And even if you hear something you don't like, you kind of listen to it and try and find something about it you do like so you can apply that to what you do.
So really, you know, you didn't start off way at the beginning playing drums thinking you would record them, but
not at all.
Probably that was born out of, well, I think I can make this sound better. And once you got the opportunity, you jumped on it.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, really, initially, I think my thought initially with the studio was like, this will be great for my band. You know, it's like I'll have access to this nice 24-track studio and a good mic collection, and I'll know how to work everything. And, you know, ultimately, one of our last, the band I played in, one of the last records we did, you know, I had my mentor, this guy, Steve Ligorio, he came in and recorded the drums and all the basics, and then I went ahead and did vocals and I mixed it. But it was like, you know, there I was. I finally got to work in my own studio on my own music. But that was, you know, years later, it's like there was a shift to where, I mean, the whole time I was in the band, I was fully into the band. But then once I didn't have a band anymore, once we decided to call it quits, all of a sudden my focus started to shift. I started caring less about playing drums and more about recording drums. And it was like, and I can remember, you know, it used to be if I heard a new piece of music, I would say, oh, you know, as a drummer, it's like, this is what I'd play. I'd do this in the verse, do this on the chorus, make sure I highlight this, highlight that. And then eventually it switched to, wow, what a cool piece of music. You know, I could get this guy to play drums on it and we would, you know, work on this, you know, and I'd make sure he played this way. It was never about me playing drums. It was about me offering the presentation, you know, in the best light possible. So it was I don't know. It was like a paradigm shift, I guess. And then all of a sudden, I mean, I can still play, but I don't play. You know, I don't really even have a drum kit anymore. And the only time I play is when I'm doing a session, I tune the drums. And so I'll play for 5 minutes. That's about all the drumming I get in anymore. So,
well, but because you had that experience on the drums, you have the drummer's perspective.
Absolutely.
And that's what drummers appreciate when you're mixing for them,
well,
I would think.
Well, and also I think it's, you know, it's not only the perspective, but it's hopefully speaking a drummer's language, because, you know, I've recorded people that have recorded elsewhere, and then they come and record with me, and they're always like, you know, drummers, I should say, they're always shocked at kind of, I guess, the level of attention I give it. I mean, yeah, you know, the drums are obviously important. I give everybody the same attention. It's not like I only focus on the drums, but I think that's what makes a great recording, is that you give everything the utmost attention to detail. And, you know, drummers are so used to people saying, hey, that's pretty cool, but, you know, can we tape the drums up? They sure are ringing a lot. And, you know, I'm just going to put this mic here. Can you try not to hit it? And, you know, it's like, well, wait, why do I tape my drums up? Why is that microphone there? I'm going to hit that. There's no question I'm going to hit that. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like there's no thought about like, you know, what's so uncomfortable. I mean, really, recording can be a very uncomfortable situation. You know, I've always kind of likened it to, you know, it's like a hospital is a horrible place to be sick. And really, recording studios are kind of a horrible place to make recordings, because they're so unlike what...
That's ironic, too.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I mean, you think about it. What do you do normally? You set up next to all the guys and everybody, you can hear yourselves and you can hear each other and you play. Or maybe you're playing in front of an audience and, you know, there's some kind of feedback. But in a studio, it's like, well, this amp's in that room and this amp's in that room and everyone's got headphones on and it's completely foreign. And it's like, okay, you guys comfortable? Let's do this. You know, and it's like, so it takes time to get to where you appreciate that environment for what it is. But early on, which, you know, I had a lot of people that it was their first time in the studio, you know, you got to make them comfortable and,
sure.
and you got to show them that you care, because you want them to be, it's like by the time you go through all the trouble of getting all the sounds, you want them to be excited about what they're hearing. So it's like, man, this is going to be great. You know, this guy really, you know, he's really gone to bat for us. He really wants this record to turn out great for us. So, you know, now it's like, now we're ready. We're in the zone. Let's perform. Let's perform like we've never played the song before. So I think all of that is kind of a buildup, you know, the working on the drum sound, making sure the drummer's comfortable, making sure the mics aren't interfering with what he's doing, making the drums, you know, tune the drums so they sound better than they ever sounded. You know, all these things are just steps to put the drummer and the band in the right mindset. So by the time you start recording, they're like, man, we can't wait to get started.
So you think that because you have this background in drumming and now you've brought that experience to mixing and recording, do you think that because of the emphasis you give to drums, that has helped you with recording and mixing the other parts of the band to make sure they sound optimal as well?
Well, you know, I think that that's more just hopefully of me being a musician. And I mean, I was somewhat of a band leader in my band, so I'm used to not just thinking about my drums, you know? I mean, there are different types of musicians, you know, as you know, they're the guys that are, there are drummers, there are guitar players, there are bassists, and then there's musicians. And you've probably played with both, you know, guys that are really like, say, a guitar player whose whole thing is about guitar, and he stands right in front of his amp and he plays as loud as he wants and he's not really concerned about what everyone else is doing. And, you know, drummers can be very much guilty of that as well. And so, but I think I was always more of a musician in that, yeah, I cared about my drum parts, but I was always listening to everybody else's parts. And I know how they interact and how what I do affects what the others are going to do and how what they do affects what I'm going to do. So, you know, to me, that's the perspective that I bring into a recording, is that, you know, everyone always says, you know, vocal, you know, the vocals are it, the vocals king. That's what everybody, you know, keys into it. And that's true, but the music is so important. And it's not just important to musicians. It's important to everybody, because if it wasn't important, then everybody would just be recording things with a vocal and maybe a piano and nothing else, but they don't. The tracks are huge. You know, people send me 100 tracks of instruments and they're saying, yeah, man, but the vocal's really important. It's like, well, then why'd you send me 100 tracks of instruments? It's
right.
That not important too, of course. It's like that, the way all of that fits together is what makes the song what it is. You know, it's just like when people say it's so important, you got to hear the lyrics. It's so important. It's like, yes, you do have to hear the lyrics. But if you think about how people react to a song the first time they hear it, they may remember one line of the lyrics, but they're going to remember something about that song. It may be the melody, maybe the sound of the guy's voice, it may be the snare sound, it could be a guitar solo, it could be, there's all these things that will make people remember a song. And it's not, it's not the lyrics. It's like you don't listen to a song one time and now I connect with that lyric. I know exactly what it's saying. It's like half the time your ear is jumping from one thing to another, but there's something about it that's compelling and makes you want to listen to it. So, you know, I think it all deserves attention, you know, and when you're working on, if you're doing just drums, then that's going to get all my attention. And while I'm working on a drum sound, that's all I think about. And I don't want to think about the bass guitar or the guitars. And then when I'm done with the drums, then I move on to the bass. And it's like, don't talk to me about drums right now. We're getting the bass going. You know, it's like this, it's just, that's just how it is.
So that's actually a good segue to, you know, your book, Recording Drums, The Complete Guide, which I think is pretty fantastic book. I mean, I think it was it's a book that I think many people, many drummers kind of have been waiting for, because it's specific and broad at the same time. It's about recording drums. So, as time went by, when were the seeds for the book planted? What prompted you to begin thinking that you needed to put all of this together in that format?
Well, it wasn't like a real specific idea that I said, you know, I want to be an author. Because if you even ask me now, do you want to be an author? It's not really like one of my aspirations. I'm certainly proud that I completed the book, but it wasn't, you know, even in retrospect, it's not like, oh man, this is finally I get to write a book. You know, it's nothing like that. But it was more just born out of, you know, back in the MySpace days, I used to contact bands a lot that way. I used to get a lot of work through MySpace. And, but usually when you make contact with bands, there would be people who say, yeah, you know, we're recording something at home and we're having trouble with the drums for, you know, this reason, or we're having trouble with the guitars. And they would describe to me what's going on. And then I would send them back this 4 or 5 paragraph email telling them what they need to worry about and what they need to think about, what they need to fix. And then a few weeks later, you get an email back saying, dude, it fixed. It's fantastic. We had no idea it could come out this well. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, you should write a book about this. I mean, I probably heard that 30 or 40 times, people saying, man, thanks for the help. You should really write a book about this. And it's like, so it was kind of a, well, let's see if everybody's right. You know, let me just see if I can kind of get some ideas together. So at some point, I just started writing some stuff. And it wasn't really focused, but, you know, I just kind of started just, you know, opening a document, started typing some stuff, thinking about what it could be, but it really didn't have, like, you know, a point on the front of it, I guess would be the way to say it. It was just kind of like just a bunch of ideas and thoughts about where I might want to go. Well, I went to record a band in Cincinnati, a guy who's become a good friend. At the time, we were going to record at a studio that was in a church in Cincinnati. It's owned by, I'm like sitting here thinking of his name. It's like all of a sudden I'm drawing a blank here.
Some guy.
Yeah, no, but he's not some guy. He's like really important to me. It's Ashley. Sorry. Ashley Shepard owns this studio. It's called Audio Grotto. You should look it up because it's a beautiful, beautiful studio. But he actually bought this church. And so the main recording room was this massive, you know, the sanctuary of this church. And it was great. Really easy to record drums in there. But, you know, I went there. I did my usual thing. Ashley's really excellent engineer, and you know, we were talking a bit about things. And I think the guy who I was working for, this guy Brett Scharf, who again he's from Cincinnati, he said, oh yeah, you know, Ashley had written a book about something about Pro Tools. You know, he wrote a book, you know, a long time ago, and that's something he does. I was like, oh, that's interesting. So then I start talking to Ashley, and told him my idea with this whole book thing, and he said, yeah, man, you should do it. He said, but, you know, I said, well, how do you start? And so he gave me a few tips about, you know, outlining and this and that, things that I would never have thought of because I, you know, again, I had no aspirations of being an author.
Right.
So this wasn't like, oh, yeah, I know what to do. So Ashley kind of gave me these kind of ideas. So then I thought, okay, I'm going to go back and make a huge outline. So I made a massive, really detailed outline. And all of a sudden it seemed like, okay, maybe I could do this. And after I wrote like an introduction and I think I wrote a chapter or most of the first chapter and I had an outline, and he connected me with Cengage Learning, who ended up being the publisher. He connected me with a guy who's the acquisitions editor there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just told the guy, I said, well, I got this idea for a book. It's about recording drums. I said, I've seen some other books. I think there's a lot of stuff that hasn't been covered. So I may have a way to do it. And he said, send me what you got. Let me see it. I said, okay. So I submitted my outline and my chapter and my introduction. And he wrote back. He said, this is great. Let's do this. I was like, that's it? I mean, that's it? He's like, yeah, you know. So they sent over a contract. I signed a contract and then I missed every deadline from that point on. So it was,
of course, like, it was, that's how it happens.
I think it was supposed to take about a year, and it probably took me 2.5 years from when we actually started the whole process. Yeah, because, you know, I have kids and I stay at home with, you know, my son. We homeschool my son, and there's all these, you know, going picking up my daughter at school and taking her to gymnastics. There's all these things that, you know, go in my life, and it wasn't like I could just sit down and write for 8 hours a day. Not that I would really want to sit down and write for 8 hours a day, but, you know, it was one of those things that between staying busy and, you know, taking care of the kids and, you know, actually spending time with my wife, you know, it was hard to just be a full-time author. But nonetheless, I think the time and distance that it took made it a better book ultimately. But
right,
that's where it stood up.
Well, it is a very content-rich book, and it definitely shows that you had paid attention to the detail. So that's a good job there.
Thank you.
So as time is going on, you're preparing the content of the book. What topics did you feel needed the most attention, or maybe what questions did you hear the most that you felt the book needed to address?
Well, I think the big thing that I was hoping to address with the book was I didn't want it to be like a tips and tricks kind of book, because I think there's tips and, you know, there's like an overload of tips and tricks everywhere on the internet. You know, there's lots of things that can say, oh, here's what I do for snare drum, and they'll show you the way they tape two microphones together, and they point it here and they run it through this mic preamp, and this is how I get my snare sound. It's like it's too I don't think it's detailed enough. I don't think it really gets into the how and the why. And so I wanted the book to be all about the how and the why. So, because I know that once I was exposed to higher level thinking, and once I started thinking at a higher level, is when things got better. You know, it's like when you first start recording, typically if you can get all the mics up and running and you've got level and there's signal going to tape and you can record something, I mean, that's like a little victory. But then at some point you need to go beyond the just basic operation of it. So then you start thinking about, well, okay, now let's try and work on mic placement within each mic. Like, you know, this is a good place to put the snare mic. Oh, it's a little bright. Well, maybe I need to move it a little further over the edge of the drum. Okay, there. Uh-huh. So you get these little changes. But then the next step is like, okay, well, now I got all these, but they don't always work together. I get a cool snare sound by itself, and I get a cool kick sound by itself, and the overhead sound good by themselves. And I put them all together, it sounds awful. So what's going on here? So then you start thinking about the way it all interacts. You know, because there are timing relationships, there are phase relationships, and those were the kinds of things that I was hoping, you know, not even so much to explain, because, I mean, I think I do explain it in the book, but it was as much about getting people to understand and notice the difference, that how one mic sounds one way, but then two mics together sound different than just that one mic, and there's a reason for that. So, you know, typically with anything we do, you know, again, getting back to drums, you know, it's one thing when you first start playing to just be able to play in time and basically, you know, hit everything in the right place at the right time, you know, but then beyond that, you start thinking about, well, am I burying the kick beater in the, you know, in the head? Oh, you know, I need to work on that. It's like, oh, am I leaving the stick on the snare after I hit it? Well, I need to work on that. Is my hi-hat too open? Well, I need, you know, so there's all these little adjustments that you make as a drummer that just make you sound better and better. Working on the internal dynamics of the kit. And, you know, so it was that same, it's probably the same process that I went through trying to be a better drummer. It's the same thing I went through as a recording engineer. And that, it's like, I wanted to maybe expose people to thinking about it that way. You know, I don't want it to be like, this is the Mike Major method for recording drums. Cause you know, that's silly. You know, it's just, this is how I think to get to my method of recording drums. And that's, you know, it's like, I don't really want to tell anybody how to do anything. It's more just make sure you're thinking about everything. You know, you don't ever just throw a mic up kind of willy nilly and not think about what its role is and how it interacts with everything else in the picture.
Well, you gave that example at the beginning about the person who puts a video up and shows how he mics his snare or whatever.
Yeah.
That might apply for that person. Whereas the book takes you to, you know, whatever your situation is, these are the guidelines you can go by to get your sound the way you want it.
Exactly. I mean, I can remember several very specific incidents during, you know, things that people told me early on that I use now. But when they told them to me, it was like, what the hell? What? Yeah, we just do this, and then all of a sudden you get this, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to try that. And you try it the next session, it doesn't work at all. And you're just like, I don't know what these guys are talking about. And at first, you know, you dismiss it as being something that, you know, maybe it just doesn't work. But then 6 weeks later, a month later, 3 months later, a year later, if something comes up and you try it again with a new perspective and more knowledge, and all of a sudden it works, and you're like, oh, that's what he was talking about. So,
yeah,
you know, I'm trying to give people maybe a little more access to those kind of light bulb moments, you know, where it's like, you know, things that maybe took me years and years to figure out. It's like, okay, well, here, think about this, think about this, think about this. Now go do your thing, you know?
Yeah. So from the recording and or mixing perspective then, and you address this in the book, but so what is the factor that most determines how good the drums will sound in the final mix? Is it the drums? Is it the drummer? The mixing technique? So you mentioned dynamics. You mentioned tuning the drums. So what factors make the drums sound the best in the final mix?
Well, nothing beats a great drummer, you know, because I've recorded some great drummers on some pretty crummy kits that turned out really well. And I've had some really awful drummers on beautiful kits that never turn out well, never. And it's like, so it really starts and ends with a great drummer. Now, you know, everything kind of, I guess there's a hierarchy there of, you know, it's the drummer. And then below that, I would say great drums are right up there and in conjunction with good tuning. Because I can take just okay drums and tune them well, and it's going to be fine if you have a great drummer. But then beyond that, you go down, it's microphones and mic placement. And then after that, you know, it kind of comes to some of it's mixing, some of it might be producing, because it's a matter of kind of having, you know, really all the greatest drum sounds, all the greatest drum performances are usually something like a bunch of elements working kind of in concert where someone had a vision. Someone heard that guy play the song. It may have been a producer, it may have been someone in the band, but they heard the guy play the song and they said, I know what we need to do with this. Uh-huh. And it's a matter of maintaining that vision and that perspective from beginning to end. You know, it's like you were saying about, you know, we had talked about this actually off air about, you're talking about this Rush thing, that if they were unhappy with that mix on, what was it? What record was it? It was
Vapor Trails.
If they were unhappy with that mix when it came out, something went wrong somewhere, because now you said the mix is really good. Well, what happened? Well, at the mix, somebody took it somewhere that no one wanted it to go. How it got there? Well, there's a lot of reasons why things like that happen, but
sure.
But the bottom line is, when things are, you know, when that thread is kind of, you know, the tension on that thread is maintained from the very beginning to the very end, is when things are just right. And it doesn't happen often enough, you know? You know, I can think of records I've done that someone else mixed, or, you know, things that other people tracked or whatever. You know, it's like there's so many reasons that things can go wrong along the ways. Sometimes it's even just the band's idea. You know, maybe you're thinking this is all messed up and the band's going, this is perfect. It's exactly what we wanted. You know, it's
right.
But, you know, in a very pure sense, I don't think there's any doubt that if you have a great drummer and the drums are tuned, and you're in a good room, and you've got a decent mic selection, and you're careful about the way you record them, and then you mix them with that same vision. I mean, it's like, yeah, that's all you have to do. I mean, I say it sarcastically. It's like, yeah, that's all you have to do, because it's getting all of it right. It's so hard to do. It's so hard to get it all right, you know.
Well, that hierarchy that you mentioned actually applies. So, you know, that mix of Vapor Trails back then maybe wasn't that good, but since the drumming was that good,
yeah,
those are things that, you know, in the end, maybe at first the listener will overlook because, you know, the music and the drumming is that good.
Right.
But if the drumming isn't that good, then it highlights all the other faults of the recording.
Right. Yeah, and it's I mean, you know, nowadays I mostly mix, and I always feel a responsibility when I'm sent tracks that it's like, I got to get every last ounce of everything out of that track, because most of the time people will send me stuff and they've never really heard it. I don't know. They've never really heard it probably as good as it should sound. Uh-huh. And so, you know, to me, that's my responsibility as a mixer, is that you send me tracks that you recorded maybe adequately, and I'm going to try and fix all the little timing and phase problems that you didn't catch, you know, because it's much easier to do that in, you know, in the digital domain. It's easy to slide tracks forward and backward and get things aligned and all that. So sometimes I can make it better than they expected it to be, and hopefully closer to what they were trying to do in the first place, you know?
Right.
But then even that, there are times that I think, wow, what a great mix. I'm so happy with this. And you send it off and they're just like, yeah, no, you know, we really wanted this to sound much smaller and much more. It's like, oh, okay. So we start over, you know, it's
right.
You never know. But at the same time, I mean, to me, it's kind of like playing drums when you're improvising, you know, you really just, you're kind of, it's seat of the pants and you go with your gut and you hope it's right. And that's kind of how I mix. It's like, when I push the faders up the first time, it hits me a certain way, and that's what I go with.
Right.
It's like I get that vision in my head. You know, it's like I hear it after I've done the first rough mix. I hear the song, and then I know what I want it to sound like, and then I just work towards that end. And, you know, that's probably emotionally the hardest thing about mixing, is that sometimes you really think, man, I've really done something with this, and you send it off, and then the notes come back, and you're just like, God, I wasn't even close to what they wanted.
Right.
So,
well, at least you establish yourself at least a baseline.
Yeah.
Where in the end, maybe there aren't too many things to tweak.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are some possibly, well, and then you can, it's easy to work with afterwards.
Well, 90-95% of the time, what I think the first time is usually what they're happy with. But it's just there are times now and then that you'll do something and it just seems so like you missed it by so much. You're just like, God. Man, I didn't hear it that way.
What was I hearing?
Yeah, it's like, I didn't hear it that way at all. Okay, I get, and then you got to completely shift your perspective and kind of dig back in and make it more like they want it to be. So, you know.
Well, let me ask you then about a real-world situation that a subscriber to the paradiddler.com encountered, and maybe, you know, we can get your take on it.
Okay.
Okay, he sent me a CD of their band. It's really great music. And he asked me to give my opinion, and because I have a drummer's ear, for obvious reasons, yeah. I pointed out that even though I thought the recording in general sounded good, I thought the drummer pretty much got the shaft as far as the drum recording went. I told him that I thought it could have been better, and he actually agreed. And what he told me was that he didn't have as much time with the engineer as he would have liked, and he ended up taking one for the team just to get the CD out. Right. So my question is, if you're a drummer with, you know, in his case, limited engineering time, which probably happens often, what can a drummer do within those constraints to ensure that they get as good a recording as possible from their drums? And, you know, maybe if you could apply those suggestions to both studio and live settings, that might be helpful.
Well, I mean, getting back to the, as we were talking about, this hierarchy that exists,
right?
There's nothing better than just being a good drummer. There's nothing better than having a good drum kit. There's nothing better than having new heads. Nothing better than having your drums tuned, and, you know, really, and then of course being able to deliver a great performance,
which he did, by the way. So
see,
he got that part out of the way as far as the performance.
And see, the sad thing about it is that what happened to him, short of somebody else doing it, that there's little you can do. You know, it's like sometimes, I mean, you really are at the mercy of whoever records you. I mean, there's a reason that some people stay busier than others. There's a reason that. You know, cheap studios are cheap. You know what I mean? It's like,
you know,
sadly it is the, you get what you pay for. There's certainly exceptions because sometimes you have people that are just getting started, but really kind of have a good grasp on it or just don't do too much to cause any damage, which, happens more than you might know. I mean, honestly, I would say most of the time when I get tracks that are not, you know, what I would say are suboptimal, it's usually people doing too much. It's usually people trying to do too much when, in fact, if they just put the microphones around the kit and just recorded them, you'd really be in better shape than you would than if they think they can optimize each mic. And, you know, just like I was saying earlier, where, yeah, the kick sounds good by itself, the snare sounds good by itself, the overheads sound good by themselves, but you put it all together and it just doesn't work. Well, that's the trick. And a lot of the damage comes when people are more concerned about getting that snare just right, getting that kick just right, without considering the whole picture. And more than likely, from what you told me, I mean, from what you just said about this recording, the rest of it probably did sound okay. But, you know, it's not as difficult to record, to basically record guitars and bass and vocals and keyboards as it is to record drums. The drums have always, to me, been the kind of determining factor of how good a studio is or how good an engineer is, because it totally sticks out when it's a bad drum sound. And it's right. It always smacks of someone with a little bit less experience than you'd wish they had, you know? I've heard so many records like that start with like a guitar intro or something. You're like, wow, the guitar sounds really good. Then the drums come in and it just all goes away. It's like, it's ruined all of a sudden because the drums are, they're substandard. So, really in this guy's case, I mean, the only other solution, I hate to say, you can have someone remix it. Who hopefully has a little more experience. I mean, that's one of the advantages of, especially nowadays, it's a little easier to get the tracks and send them to somebody else and have them remix it, because there may be something salvageable there. But getting back to the original thought of it, if he's a good drummer and he's got a good kit and he's got new heads and he plays well and the room's okay, I mean, he's done everything he can. At that point, you're really at the mercy of the engineer. And the same is true for live sound, like you were saying. It's the same thing. If you, if the PA is well-tuned and the guy out front doesn't try to go too crazy, then there's really no reason for the drums not to sound good. I mean, I would go so far as saying when you got a pretty good-sized PA system, it's pretty hard to make the drums sound bad. You know what I mean? There's something about that power and volume that just forgives all sins, that's the thing when we're working on recordings that we're trying to kind of replicate, is that power that you get when it's playing through a PA at 110 dB. That's powerful. There's no denying it. Even a crummy sounding kit still sounds powerful when it's at 110 dB. But on a recording, you don't have that benefit, Plus you don't have the visual of people seeing the band playing and the lights and, everybody's, bodies rubbing up against each other in the crowd and everything. You don't have any of that. You just listen. So, it ain't easy.
So pretty much, as far as the drummer goes, they should just focus on what they can control, basically. Yeah. Their performance, their quality of drums, the drums being tuned right, and pretty much.
And you actually alluded to it at the beginning. He said he didn't have enough time. That's the other factor. It's just the time, mm-hmm. Big records sound good because they get to spend a lot of time. You can argue that it's largely because, you've got people who are ultimately more qualified, who've been doing it for a long time. Yeah, that makes a difference. But, I know that when I make a recording, when I've got, certain number of hours per song, well, if I double that number of hours per song, there's no question it's going to come out better. There's no question, because I've got more time to work on things. I've got more time to sweat the little details. I've got more time to try things out that may make a significant difference, instead of just being, hurry up, get it up, got level. Okay, let's go, guys. We got to be out of here by 8 o'clock. You only paid for this many hours. We got to be out of here by 8 o'clock. It's like, that to me, that's a horrible way to do it.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, well, that's good advice, by the way. I think that,
time,
that might be exact. That might be something that, maybe a lot of drummers, they might be, pawning off to someone else as far as the responsibility, where, it's take care of your own thing. Make sure you got your stuff down pat.
Absolutely. And the only thing they can take from that is that if they go to a studio and they know their drums sound good, and believe me, lots of musicians are delusional in how good they really are. There's no question that, but he got your independent opinion. You said it sounded like he's a good drummer and it's a great performance. So, you could say it's been independently confirmed that he's a good drummer, and basically the recording did not come out like it should have. But, I've certainly recorded many guys that they think they sound wonderful, and then they come in here the first playback and they're like, man, why does it sound like that? It's like, that's, what do you mean? That's how you play. I mean, that's it. I can remember, it wasn't a drummer, but I can remember one vocalist. It was, believe it or not, it was like a karaoke thing years and years and years ago. And she was, really nice girl and had a pretty good voice. And she was doing this karaoke stuff, and it was just me recording her over some other backing tracks. And she came in and said, I don't really like the way my voice sounds. I was like, that sounds just like your voice. Yep, she goes, no, but it's like, I, like on the record, you know, it's this. I said, I mean, was it the $5,000 microphone or was it the $2,000 mic preamp or was it the $3,500 compressor that you think is ruining your voice? It's like, I'm using nothing but top of the line stuff on you. I'm setting, you know, good, clean levels. It's going to a top of the line digital recorder and you're listening through it through a fantastic sounding pair of monitors in a good sounding control room. And yet you say you don't like how your voice sounds. So I'm not doing anything. I'm just putting great stuff in front of you and it's capturing you. And she didn't like that. She was like, yeah, but it doesn't sound like I want it to. I was like, well, that's your voice. I think it sounds nice. You got a nice voice. And she refused to accept that it was that. She said it was me, that there was something I was doing to ruin it. So, you know, there's another side to that too, you know, but at least in your case, you have independent confirmation.
Well, I mean, the drummer has to work on themselves. So does the guitarist, the bass player, the singer also.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the Method to the Mix YouTube series that you're putting up. But before we do that, it's just a question that I think some drummers have that, you know, maybe they have been recording themselves with a webcam or maybe one USB microphone and they want to start getting a little more serious about the quality of their drum recording. Mm-hmm. So what do you recommend to someone who's just starting out as far as the simplest, most affordable setup that can get them a respectable quality recording? Nothing extravagant, just like to start off with.
Right.
What they would need, basically.
Well, you know, just like with drums, you know, I think it helps if you're going to buy equipment to spend as much as you can possibly afford on any particular piece, you know, that good microphones don't ever stop being good microphones. So, you know, the biggest mistake I think people make initially is that they'll go and buy a bunch of cheap mics just so they can get a mic on everything. And then, right. Like, well, this is great. But then you got a bunch of cheap mics on everything and you've kind of set the ceiling of the quality of what it can ever be based on what those mics are capable of. But if you instead start simply and get, you know, a good kick drum mic, and there's plenty of them out there, and maybe a good pair of mics for your overhead, you know, for overheads, and then maybe a snare mic, and really a 57, which is cheap by microphone standards, you know, always, I mean, I still use a 57 on every recording. I may have something else on the snare, but I use a 57 on the snare drum every time.
The 57 is what brand is that? Is that the model?
The Shure SM57. It is the most ubiquitous mic in the world. It's everywhere. Everyone's used them. They're everywhere, and they're cheap. But they are the perfect snare drum mic, you know. And they work great on guitars too, you know. And honestly, sometimes I use them for toms just because there's something about the way they sound on certain kits that I just really really like a lot. But you know, the bottom line is, you know, if you start with a few good mics and not worry about buying a bunch of mics, then, you know, you're going to at least always have the highest quality capture device possible. You know, just like if you buy a cheap cymbal stand, eventually that's going to break or it's going to, you know, it's going to slip when you got a cymbal on it, or, you know, it's like there are things that it will fail you at some point, but, you know, a good
inherit to the quality.
Yeah, absolutely. A good cymbal stand will last forever. You know, so microphones are the same way. Good microphones will always sound good, you know. I mean, short of being damaged, you know, they always sound good. So, you know, it helps to have a good kick mic, a good snare mic, and then something really good for overheads, you know, because personally I think the overheads are the foundation for every drum sound. You know, that's it. That's kind of where I start. If I get those sounding right, the rest of it seems much less significant, you know. I mean, even though I use close mics, I use a ton of mics, there's no question, but it's all based on what I'm getting in the overheads and having a good pair of mics up there and having them placed right.
And of course, all this stuff is covered in detail in the Recording Drums, the complete guide.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there is the last chapter, I go through a bunch of different setups from one microphone all the way up to, I don't know, I think 12 or 13 was the largest setup that we did in that. But, you know, the idea being that some people only have one microphone. And it's important.
Where do you put it?
Yeah, exactly. Where do you put it? But it's important that whatever your, you know, limitations may be, you can't think of it like a limitation. You got to think, I need to get a drum sound. So I'm going to do whatever I need to do. I'm going to move that mic around until I find a spot that, yeah, I'm really getting everything. You know, I'm getting a good balance of the kick, the snare, and the toms and the cymbals. Nothing's killing me. And if it is, then I need to move the mic. I need to go in another place because, you know, lots of people have made records where that was the drum sound. It was one microphone. So, you know, it's too easy to look at the people that are using 15, 16, 18 microphones and go, yeah, you know, we should.
I'll never get a good sound.
Yeah, it's like you know, we shouldn't even bother doing this. I've only got one microphone. It's like, you can't think of it that way. You just got to think about where to place it and how to get the most out of it, you know. So, so in the chapter 16, it just goes through, you know, one mic setups, two mic setups, three, four, I think, you know, and then it, just different, like adding different things. And then there are some examples on my website that you can download and listen to just so you can hear the difference of a one mic setup, a two mic setup, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Good stuff. So let's talk a little bit then, like I said, about the Method to the Mix YouTube video series. What sparked that idea to create this series?
You know, it's similar to what I did with the book, that maybe trying to expose people to hopefully like a higher level thinking about mixing. You know, because I know that, you know, balance, like establishing a balance is just one part of mixing. You know, that's something that I think some people are just naturally better at it than others. You know, that you just kind of, maybe you're just a better musician, so you kind of understand the role that everything plays within the song, and you're more likely to just put things in the right place. But that's just one part of mixing. The rest of it comes from kind of listening to a song and finding maybe the thing about that song that needs to be that defining element in the mix. And, and then on top of that, thinking about how to build it from the ground up, like, you know, for myself anyway, I usually start with the drums and then the bass and then the guitars, and I get all those working together, and then I add anything else, and then I put the vocals on top. And, you know, because of all these steps, you know, it's not just as simple as like, well, you know, you're just working on a balance. It's like, well, there's a lot more to it. So I thought if I showed the whole process from the beginning to end, then maybe it might help people to like reevaluate the way they go about mixing. Maybe they've hit like a plateau in the way their mixes will sound, and they just feel like they can't break through that ceiling and get to a better level. So I thought, well, maybe this will help people to kind of, if nothing else, just to give them a fresh perspective. They may disagree with everything,
right?
But if nothing else, it may make them think of something that they'd never thought of. I can say for sure there were many times that I worked with people when I was doing live sound, where I worked with guys that, you know, maybe I didn't like their mix at all, but there were things that they did that I could say, that's pretty cool. You know, that's a cool idea. I've never thought about that. And then the next time you sit down, you try it out, and then you make it your own and you do your own thing. So I'm kind of hoping that the Method to the Mix would do the same thing for other people.
Well, it's a good series. For those who like that kind of thing,
right.
It's really a fresh take from, you know, of every single step every step you take. And, you know, maybe some people might think that's a lot of steps, but, you know, you get the result you want when you take the time to be, you know, that specific about what you're doing.
Right. Well, it again, you know, just to tie this back to drums again, that's the way I played drums too. You know, it was never just like, oh, this is 4/4. Oh, okay. You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to play this. It's like, you think about every step, you know, you're supposed to construct a part based on like, what's the bass doing? What are the guitars doing? It's never supposed to be haphazard. And when it is haphazard, it usually sounds that way. So
right.
To me, mixing, you know, recording, it's the same thing. Anytime you think you can just kind of phone anything in, then, you know, something's going to get lost. Something's going to get lost in the translation there. And to me, it's just, you know, mixing, even though I'm somewhat methodical, the thought process is still, how can I make this song big and exciting and, you know, make people want to listen to it and make the band feel like this is it. This is what we're supposed to sound like. So, you know,
yep.
By breaking it down into all these steps allows me to forget about all that technical stuff so much, because it's just another step. But then I can just, okay, the technical thing's done. Now, what am I feeling about this?
Right.
How come I'm not jumping out of the seat yet? What's wrong with me here? Oh, that's right. Because the guitars are probably a little too quiet. If the guitars are a little loud, this might sound a little more exciting. So you push the guitars and all of a sudden you start going, oh, okay, yeah, this is starting to go somewhere. So, you know, anyway, this is what I'm trying to do with that.
Yeah, because in the end, you know, from the beginning to the end of the process, it's about the song,
Absolutely.
How it makes you feel at the end.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's very interesting too. I've like I said, I found that video series interesting, and I think a lot of people will, so they should check that out. Method to the Mix. Mike, for those who are listening that they might be interested in pursuing a career in recording? I mean, it's probably a lot different now than it was before, but do you have any suggestions that, you know, people may, that you might be able to give for those who are going towards that? Or
I think nowadays people need to be entrepreneurial, you know, because the traditional studio jobs, there's not many of them. It's not like it used to be where, you know, you could, I don't know, move out to LA and find an intern job and, you know, make $5 an hour being an intern and then eventually work your way into assistant. And, you know, it's like those don't exist so much anymore. So I think it's important for people to be entrepreneurial and work on, you know, recording bands, recording friends, going out to clubs. And, you know, it's like start off just by recording people.
Right.
For free or for next to nothing, just to get good at it, because the only way you're going to get good at it is by doing it. And you know, you need to get the hours in, you need to get the experience in, and it starts there. I think it helps to be a musician if you're not, you know, it's like you got to understand something about music, because most work in recording is recording music. I mean, you know, there are people that do TV, you know, TV shows and movies and you know, documentaries and stuff like that, but there's really no substitute for knowing something about music, because ultimately at some point you will be talking with musicians about music. And I know a band will trust me much more if I can say, yeah, you know, right there where you played the A and he played the F sharp, you know, that's working pretty well. But, you know, the next time he played a D and you were playing a C and that's not working. You know, it's like, then they've realized,
right.
It's like, hey, yeah, you know what you're talking about. I can throw this at you. You know what a verse is. You know what a chorus is. You know what something is in tune and something's out of tune, when something's in time, when something's out of time. I think you really have to develop, you know, your sense of music. And a lot of times that just means listening to a lot of music and refining your listening, you know, your listening. I'm not going to say your hearing ability, because you can't really change your hearing ability. That's that we all have some kind of innate hearing ability, whether, you know, the mechanical part of our ears works or it doesn't. But the listening ability is something that really needs to be developed, that, you know, I mean, it may take exposing yourself to someone else who does it, who can tell you how to listen more critically. I know there's books on critical listening that may not be the most exciting books, but at the same time, they may open up your thought, you know, thought process about how to listen to stuff.
Yeah, that's really a key, because you can listen to a song because you like it and you know all the nuances from the emotional perspective, but now if you want to be a recorder or a mixer or that kind of thing, you have to listen to it from another perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, I know that, you know, for example, compression was something that, you know, early on I didn't really know what compression sounded like, and the guy that I worked for, this guy Steve Ligorio, he was really a big part of everything I've learned, and was also, he was the technical editor of my book, so you know, early on he was real good about pointing things out to me. He'd go, yeah, you hear that? You hear the compression on that? And I'd be like, huh? Yeah, okay, sure. What? You know, it's like, I had no idea what he's talking about. And then all of a sudden, 6 months later, you start to notice it. And then a year later, you're just like, God, that you're right. That's a mess. You know, it's just, it's a developmental period where, you know, just as in music, you know, the more proficient you get with your instrument and the more proficiency you gain with music, then it becomes easier to understand, you know, more complicated subjects, you know, more complicated music. You know, you understand the role of everything just like quickly. It's not such a chore to go, okay, now wait a minute, what was that? Now what's the timing on that? Someone plays something for you and then you can spit it right back at them because you got it, you know. And it's like, to me, that's how listening needs to be, that you hear something and you can tell someone, you can describe exactly what's going on with that sound. That's when you know you have a, you know, a pretty developed sense of hearing. You know, you could say, oh yeah, you hear that, there's like a reflection in there, this room probably sounds like it's, I don't know, 25 feet why, and you know, it's like you can make some kind of estimation of what was done, maybe what kind of microphone they might have used to record it, if they put any effects on it, if there's an EQ problem, whatever. Those are kinds of things that you can only develop, you know, as you develop your listening ability.
Yeah, so that's something that happens over time, doing it over and over
Absolutely.
Again, having that entrepreneurial spirit, like you mentioned.
Yeah, and the entrepreneurial spirit just goes back to, you know, don't expect a job, just make a job. You know, make it
exactly.
So you know, have something that makes people want to work with you. And, you know, even that, it kind of goes back to everything else in life, but there's nothing like having a good attitude. You know, people do yep. not want to record with somebody who's unhappy to be there or who's quick to, you know, like throw out like, God, what was that, guys? Let's do that again. It's like, you know, just there's, I've worked with people like that in the studio, and it just always struck me as so strange. It's like, how can you work in the studio and, you know, finish a take and they get on the talk back and start screaming at the band about how horrible they just played? It's like, there's nothing constructive about that. There's no way anybody's going to play better after they've just been, you know, gotten a tongue lashing from, you know, right. the producer saying, ah, that was awful.
Yeah.
You know, quit wasting our time. Let's do this again. You know, it's like, what?
I'd rather just call it a day right
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Or yeah. just say, just go out and say, hey, you know, pull each guy aside and tell him what you think he might be doing and the way to correct it. Not just call him, you know, like a bunch of hacks because they can't play the song. You know, there's always a reason. So, you know, that's the thing. More development of, you know, your listening ability and, you know, I guess your decision making. You know, you can pinpoint what's wrong with a song and tell each person what they need to do to fix that.
Right. So we've hit the hour mark.
Okay.
Mike, this has been awesome. So we can go on and on and on. It's very interesting, but I have a couple more questions for you and we'll wrap it up. So what's next for you, Mike? Do you have projects that you're at liberty to speak about? Maybe even some long-term plans, or what's in it for you in the near future?
Nothing real specific. You know, I just, you know, want to stay busy. I like to work. I like to mix. I like to master. I like to do it all, you know. The only thing I would love to see happen more of, I guess, I would like to be tracking and producing a bit more, because I've gotten so stuck in the mixing world that I miss, you know, cutting basic tracks with a band and being a part of pre-production and preparing the songs and all that. I just don't get to do it much anymore. So
what is tracking again? Can you define tracking, that when you say tracking?
Yeah, tracking is recording the basic tracks, meaning you are the guy that actually starts the recording. You know, you go in to whatever the space or the studio, and you're the one that puts the microphones up. You're the one that makes the initial recording and, you know, potentially the overdubs and all that. But it is kind of the, like, really, to me, it's, without sounding corny, that's where the magic is, you know, is like when you're there right. while the song is being recorded and while it's being, you know, actually tracked, because, you know, there's a certain level of excitement when you get a take, you know, that you just don't get that when you're mixing until maybe you're almost done, you know,
right.
and with tracking, it's like it just happened and you were there, you know, and you want to make sure you do your job right. Because if you don't, you just lost a great take. You know, that's, to me, it's like, I love that pressure. I love that responsibility to capture something, you know.
You have an emotional connection.
Absolutely. You know, it's like I'm not playing. I'm not out there playing, but I'm like trying to make, you know, it's like I feel just as invested as the band does at that point. You know,
you're trying to capture a moment.
Yeah, this is our song at that point. It's not their song. It's our song, you know.
Right. Cool. So last question then from me, Mike. If anybody wants to contact you, how can they do that? What can they contact you about?
Well, the best way to get in touch with me is through my website, which is mikemajormix.com. That's mikemajormix.com. There's a contact form on the website, and that basically sends something directly to my email. So anything they want to contact me about, it could be, if you're working on a project and you're having trouble with it and you just need some advice, you can contact me. If you're uncertain about a direction, like, say, maybe you want to go, maybe you're talking about recording with somebody and you need an opinion about a couple of different people who might be doing it, you know, I'm always open to helping in that respect. But then, of course, I'm available to be hired for, you know, mixing, mastering, recording, consultation, whatever, you know, pre-production, producing, you know, all this stuff. You can contact me through the website, and I mean, really anything audio, I've probably done it at some point, but you know, I'm always looking for new things, so by all means, please contact me.
Very good. Well, Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Mike.
This is stuff that's really interesting, and I think, you know, musicians in general, but in our case, you know, the drummers, these are things that maybe they're just not sure where to go. And this has been most helpful to them. And I want to thank you for spending some time talking about this stuff. This is great.
Thank you. It was fun for me, too. Thanks for having me.
Great. Again, that was mixer, producer, and recording engineer Mike Major. To find out more on how to get the absolute best final mix for your recorded drum performances, you can get Mike's book, Recording Drums, The Complete Guide, available from Mike's website, MikeMajorMix.com, and also at theparadiddler.com, where this podcast will be posted. His website also has samples of performances he's mixed, both studio and live, and he can also be contacted there as well. I want to thank Mike Major again for spending some time with us. Very much appreciated. This is Omar Alvarado of theparadiddler.com. Thanks for listening, and keep on drumming.